From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, French filmmaker Louis Malle talks about his latest film, Au revoir les enfants, which is about to come out on home video. And he looks back on his early career as part of the French New Wave. Also today, Douglas Adams tackles the big metaphysical questions. Adams created The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and has a new bestseller featuring the return of holistic detective Dirk Gently. And we have a review of a jazz album from pianist Rand Blake and a preview of the Nightline special on Vietnam veterans and post-traumatic stress syndrome. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. French filmmaker Louis Malle moved to the United States 10 years ago. Here he made the films Pretty Baby, Atlantic City, My Dinner with Andre, Crackers, and Alamo Bay. He returned to France to make his latest film, Au revoir les enfants, or Goodbye Children. It received 2 Academy Award nominations last year. Now it's about to come out on home video. Like Malle's earlier film, La Comme Lucien, Au revoir les enfants is set in occupied France during World War II. The screenplay is inspired by what Malle describes as the most tragic memory of his childhood. In 1944, Malle's parents sent him away from Paris to a Catholic boarding school in the countryside, where they thought he'd be protected from the war. But the school was helpless when one morning the Gestapo came looking for the Jewish students whom the priests had offered sanctuary. In the notes to the film, Malle wrote, "That morning of 1944 changed my life. It may have triggered my becoming a filmmaker." I asked him to explain.
You know, it's a little difficult for me to say that and be completely sure, but it has been such a traumatic event at the age of 11 for me, and they're suddenly exposed to violence and their intolerance and, this brutality, the shock that it was for me to see those German soldiers enter our classroom and arrest one of the, one of the boys who happened to be my friend. I think it has really, long after, well, until now, as a matter of fact, but in the following years, I've been, as I was growing up, I've been trying to understand, and of course, there's nothing to understand. It's just impossible. So what happened is, I suppose what it sort of developed in me is a sort of real tenacious curiosity about trying to find out what was going on in the world outside, and I know my reaction in the following years was a reaction of anger. I couldn't understand. Of course, it was completely unacceptable. I started becoming very rebellious and very cautious about everything I heard from, the adults and teachers and my parents, and would try to convince me that was right or was true. And I wanted to find out for myself. And I think that really has triggered my urge to become a filmmaker. I thought making film was a way to try to find out about what was going on around, outside.
Your new movie is based on your childhood experience in a Catholic boarding school during the war. Did something in your life happen now that intensified those memories or that made them especially timely for you now?
Well, it took all those years, and it's just that I suppose the fact that I've been living and working in the U.S. for the last 10 years, because I was far from my roots, and also simply because, I got older, a lot of things of my past, and especially of my childhood, and especially everything around this event of my childhood, the arrestation of my friend Bonnet, and his being deported to Germany, a lot of it came back, and it became a little obsessive, very obsessive. And so it seemed like I had no choice. The same way for years I was scared to deal with it, and I was not ready. Then at some point I felt, the time has come. I must cope with it. I must try to write a screenplay, and if the screenplay seems to work, I should make a film.
Maybe there are advantages to waiting that long and having a certain emotional distance from the event?
Yes, there are several advantages, I suppose. I could have made that film when I was 25, you know, my first feature. But since I didn't do it and didn't want to do it then, I suppose it was much better for me to wait because, first, I think I was a little more on top of it as a filmmaker, and I was more in control of the medium, and I always felt I should wait because I wanted to be really completely, trying to make the best film as I could. And it seemed to me that time was working my way. And I think it was the right time for me to do it before, I don't know, before I die, before I become Gaga or whatever, but I thought it was really the right moment. And of course, emotionally, living with this memory all these years, it's not, memory is not dead, it's very much alive, it moves all the time, things happen. You look at it differently when you get older.
We all know your memory from the movie that we see, but could I ask you to describe what it was like for you in real life the day the Nazis came into your school and took away one of your friends?
Well, what I can say is, what I remember very well is it was an incredible shock. And I remember that for minutes it seemed like, like a bad dream. It didn't seem that it was possible. It seems like it was almost like in slow motion. It was something happening that not only myself, but the other boys in the classroom, we couldn't even comprehend what was going on. And then when they told us the school was closed, we had to pack, and we would have to line up in the courtyard, and we saw our friends taken away by the Germans. It seemed like... it was an incredible shock. It's probably especially for me because of my friendship with Bunny, but for instance, my older brother, who was in a different grade, and none of the children was, the Jewish children were in his grade, but still for him it was also something that he's going to remember until he dies.
My guest is director Louis Malle, and he wrote and directed the new film Au revoir les enfants. You work with child actors in this movie, children of, I guess, like 10 to 13, or something around there?
Yes.
I understand that you don't like to use professional child actors. Why is that?
Well, it's almost for practical reasons, because there's not too many child actors around anyway, at least in France, and the one I interviewed were not really actors. You know, how could you really learn your craft when you're that young and still going to school? And at the same time, I'm always when I deal with child actors, I always realize that they might have lost something. They might have lost their innocence, and they're not really children anymore. So for me, it was a lot simpler to start from scratch, and to find great children who'd never seen a movie camera before, and to find them, to work with them, finally to choose them, and to trust them with playing the characters. It's a very long process, and it takes a certain amount of tenacity and instinct and experience. But I've done that before because I've made lots of films with children, and it's always been very rewarding because I've been able to find most of the time, especially with Au revoir les enfants, the two protagonists are the best children I ever worked with. You know, they're more than actors, they're just great human beings. It was my luck to find them in a way.
Since the children don't have any acting technique, they're not professional actors, they're very young, do you have to change your directing style to give them a different kind of direction than you'd give an adult actor?
Yes, you have to do that. And that's something that, you know, there's no rules, there's no... you have to really play by ear. But basically, first what I must say is that, you know, the technique of the craft of film acting for children, for some reason, and I'm not the only one to have observed that, the good one, the gifted one, They seem to learn it very, very fast. And actually, at halfway through the shooting, they were just as experienced, it seemed to me, as, I don't know, people who'd have been actors, professional actors for 20 years. They would do everything that was required for the camera. They would, you know, I'd never had any problems with them, you know, not knowing their lines or anything like that. I had problems with some of the grown-up actors, but not with with the children. And what you gain is you know, when it works, is also you know, an incredible natural that you don't often have with actors.
This is your first French film in over a decade. Why did you make this film in France? Did you feel that this one had to be made in France, since it's set in France and since it's about your youth there?
Well, you know, about 3 or 4 years ago, I'd sort of made up my mind that I was going to do it. So at some point, which was in 86, I went back to Paris. I went back to France, and I started working on the script. And that was my, you know, my sort of re-entry in the French cinema, and working in, you know, in my language, the French language, which was, of course, great for me, because after all these years, it was very moving and, in a way, easier. But it's not that I wanted to go back and work in France again, which I did in a way, but it's I went back because I wanted to make Au revoir les enfants. That was really what I had in mind. I was obsessed with it, as I said.
Why had you left France a decade ago?
Well, for lots of reasons. I have many answers. I could just say that I came to make a film called Pretty Baby. And I'd been thinking about it and working on it for several years. And again, at that point, I felt I should do it. So it was taking place in New Orleans. It's you know, I had to come and I had to come here to make it. But then I was always interested in the American cinema. I've always been a great admirer of the, at least in the, you know, in the good old days. I think American cinema was the best. And I've always wanted at some point to work here. I was very curious about this country, which I'd visited and known pretty well before I moved here. And so it's sort of, again, it came naturally. I came to make one picture, and I stayed 10 years. I made more pictures. I enjoyed being here. I was always very curious about what was going on in this country. And time has been flying. That's what happened.
You know, you said you really liked American films from the good old days. What were the films that you really liked the most when you were coming of age?
Well, you know, we admired the American cinema for its immediacy. It seemed like, you know, I grew up with two forms of American culture that I still think, you know, the Americans were a little unique about. It was jazz and cinema. It seemed to us that they were means of expression that the Americans were better than Europeans. It might not be true about cinema, because there's been some pretty good European films, but we always felt that it had to do with the medium itself, that it was, you know, the Americans were particularly at ease with it. And over the years, you know, I had this incredible admirations for American directors, from, I don't know, John Ford to Huston, Preston Sturges, the great comedians. We just, you know, it was like a sort of an addiction for us when I was an adolescent, and then when I was in film school, and, you know, my first years as a filmmaker.
Well, it must have been really exciting to start making films in the 1950s, during the period of the French New Wave, when all these really young, exciting directors like yourself were coming of age. And the French cinema was a very intellectual cinema, in addition to, like, loving the genre films of America. I mean, directors like you and Truffaut and Godard were intellectuals as well. It wasn't really a part of the American tradition of cinema.
No, you know, there's obviously a contradiction, because in a way we admired, you know, in Jean-Luc Godard's first feature, Breathless, there's a series of homages to the great American filmmakers, but he's completely an intellectual, and his style and approach to filmmaking is completely different. It's the opposite of Hollywood. So in a way, it was a paradox. But I think we've been really nourished by the American school, and we were intellectuals in the sense that we were the first generation where we decided that film was our medium. Whether I suppose. The generation before, they would have wanted to be novelists.
Or poets.
Or playwrights. But for us, cinema was the medium. And actually, through the 60s, it was. It was a very flourishing period for the French cinema. And we sort of took over, and for years it was really exciting. And we were incredibly young. You know, I made my first feature, I was 24 years old, so... That was fun and exciting.
You know, it seems to me maybe the French cinema has changed a little bit. There's so many more French comedies coming out now, kind of sitcom-type type comedies. I don't know. What do you think?
You know, Tara, I have to say that what you see in this country of the French cinema does not necessarily reflect the real production. You see some auteur films like Eric Rohmer and a lot of comedies, because for some reason the distributors here think it's going to please American audiences, like Three Men and a Cradle, was remade as Three Men and a Baby. But there is a tradition of personal filmmaking in France which continues. Frankly, I'm not sure the French cinema is in a great period. It goes through cycles. The 60s were remarkable. The 80s are certainly not as great. But I have to say that every year they make interesting personal films. A lot of them are not shown here, unfortunately.
Well, I want to talk with you more about filmmaking, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is film director Louis Malle. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Filmmaker Louis Malle is my guest. You know, it really interests me that you got your start in filmmaking working with Jacques Cousteau, the famous underwater filmmaker and documentary filmmaker. Had you sought him out?
Well, I was in film school, and I was very lucky because one summer he asked the director of the school for an apprentice, and I think I was in the school the only one who could swim, so... They picked me, and I really wanted to go. I was interested in documentaries. I was interested in Cousteau's work as a filmmaker, which was very interesting. And so I spent 2 months on the Calypso as an apprentice. And at the end of the summer, Cousteau told me that the man who was in charge of filmmaking with him, his assistant, was leaving because he was getting married. And do you want the job? I was not even 20 years old. I was in the middle of film school, and of course I said yes. How could I refuse? And I knew nothing, you know, but I worked very hard, and I learned about editing, photography. I became an underwater cameraman, and we came up 3 years later with a feature documentary called The Silent World. And Cousteau has been incredibly nice and great class, because he offered me to be the co-director, which he didn't have to do. So I was co-director at the age of 23 of a film which won the Golden Palm at the Cannes Festival. The Oscar for feature documentary was an immense success, and so that was my start, and that was an incredible break for me.
You know, it's almost I'd almost expect that in one of your movies you would have found an underwater scene with someone wrestling an octopus just to
I've been
just to show off your skills there.
For 30 years, but it never happened. I've kept in touch with Cousteau, and he's offered me several times to come back and work with him again, which I would love to do, actually, but it never happened.
Maybe I'm making too much of this, but getting your start in documentary films, did that teach you a certain emotional distance, teach you how to shoot something that was really exciting and compelling without really wringing every bit of emotion out of it?
Well, I don't know. The one thing that it did for me, I got so interested in this kind of direct cinema without a script, just filming something happening in front of you, I've always found fascinating. And throughout my career, I've kept making personal documentaries about all kinds of subjects. I filmed in India. I film in this country. I made two documentaries in the last few years in America. And this has always been a very important part of my work and very necessary for me to go back to the real world with a camera and so I think it has certainly had an influence on my fiction work too, but how to define it, I really don't know. What it probably has helped me to sort of define a style where I'm trying to get from the actors I'm directing the same kind of immediacy that I'm dealing with when I'm shooting documentaries.
You know, one of your feature films really walks the line between documentary and fiction film, and I'm thinking of My Dinner with Andre, which was basically a film about a long dinner conversation between Andre Gregory and Wallace Shawn. It's a wonderful movie, and it seems to me it's one of the most self-effacing movies on your part as a director, because it's a movie that really calls attention in a way to the actors and to the screenplay, and you think, well, this must have been easy to direct. It's just two people at a dinner table talking. But it must have been actually very, very difficult to direct a dinner table conversation and keep it as interesting as you did.
To keep it together, it was actually incredibly difficult. It's one of the, of my directing work that has given me more work. It's been really, because it's the whole point. It was when you said self-effacing, that's exactly what I was trying to do. I didn't want to certainly not to show off. I just wanted them to be as good as possible. I wanted the conversation to be as interesting as possible. I wanted the whole thing to work, which was a real challenge, because it seemed absurd to make a film like 2 hours about two characters discussing in a restaurant. So the whole point was at the end that it seemed like I've just been shooting them, and when actually we rehearsed for months. I work with them more than I ever worked with actors. I think I've directed Wally and Andre Gregory more than I've done ever. And I've done the same thing in a way with Au revoir les enfants, because it was a lot of work, but it's always what I'm trying to do. I hate to show off with the camera. I hate to demonstrate that I'm a good director. I hate to be too present. One of the things I'm proud of with Au revoir les enfants, the last one, is that I think the spectator very, very soon forgets that there is a camera. And there's a lot of people have told me it's almost like a different experience that normally you have when you're watching a film. There's such an immediacy between the actors and what's going on the screen and your own emotions watching it, that it's almost there's nobody in between. Of course, in between there's, the work we've done, but it's meant not to show.
Well, as we mentioned before, Au revoir les enfants is your first French film in a decade. When you went back to France to make it, did you think a lot about how, if at all, your directing and filmmaking techniques had changed since you left France for America?
I don't think it has changed too much. I think what I've learned here is maybe a slightly different sense of rhythm. I suppose what I've done here is more like fine-tuning what I think is my style, which is to always privilege the actors over the camera, and to understand that filmmaking is a very collaborative art, and you work with the crew, but mostly you work with the actors. That's what it's all about. And some of us, including myself, at the beginning of the new wave, we were on a sort of ego trip. we were the first one to claim that the director was everything.
Mm-hmm.
The script was not important. In a way, the actors were, like Hitchcock was saying, actors were objects. I've come back from that 100%. I think now that I keep thinking and I keep telling my technicians, we're not on the screen. The actors are on the screen, and they're the one who carry the picture. We must help them. We must submit to everything that's going to make their work, which is very difficult, easier. And so that's what I've been trying to do all these years. But here, where the director is not as this sort of egomaniac they often are in Europe, that's maybe one of the things I've learned working here. And I think it's good in a way, because I'm very conscious of my privileges, and being the director, I'm the one who's supposed to make the final decisions. In the case of Au revoir les enfants, I wrote it, I directed it, I produced it. It's completely my work in a way. But the one thing I can say, I think if it works, it's because the people on the screen are great.
We only have a minute left. Two things I want to ask you very quickly. One is, you said you think your rhythm has changed a little since you moved to America. How so?
Well, it's just because when I'm comparing my work here, or even Au revoir les enfants, to a film like La Combe Lucien, La Combe Lucien was much slower. Au revoir les enfants, which is a chronicle, which becomes a tragedy, if you want to simplify. I was just trying to accumulate little, details at the beginning to show what it was to be a child in those years in a school, and there's a lot of that. But I was very preoccupied with to keep the structure sort of flowing, which is something that I suppose I've learned here.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your work. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Louis Malle's most recent film, Au revoir les enfants, will soon be out on home video. His 1971 film, Murmur of the Heart, has just been re-released. It will open in New York this Friday and will go into national release soon. The Miles Davis soundtrack from Malle's 1957 film, Frantic, is about to be reissued by Polygram Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with novelist E.L. Doctorow. His new book, Billy Bathgate, is about a character who falls in with gangster Dutch Schultz. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Douglas Adams created what he himself modestly describes as the most wholly remarkable book in the known universe, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Coming up, Douglas Adams talks about his new book, The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul, featuring the further comic adventures of holistic detective Dirk Gently. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Painted Rhythms, Volume 2, the new album from composer and pianist Rand Blake. And television critic David Bianculli previews this Wednesday's extended edition of Nightline on Vietnam veterans and post-traumatic stress syndrome. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The federal government and the Teamsters Union reached a settlement today, averting a trial for 11 members of the union's executive board. The agreement does not call for the resignations of current members of the executive board, and no government trustee will be appointed to run the union. Instead, a three-member panel will be appointed to look into corruption by Teamsters officials. And for the first time, rank-and-file union members will be allowed to participate in direct elections of their leaders. Before dropping civil charges against the union leaders, the government had alleged a pattern of racketeering, which included murder, extortion, and misuse of funds. Israel's Foreign Minister Moshe Arens met with President Bush and Secretary of State James Baker today. The focus of their talks was the Middle East peace process. The president called on Israel to come up with new ideas to help move the parties toward direct negotiations. Details from NPR's Ann Garrels.
Secretary of State Baker reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to Israel's security while calling for a settlement that also addressed the legitimate political rights of the Palestinians. The Bush administration discussed various steps that could be taken by Israel to ease tensions in the occupied West Bank and Gaza as a way to lay the groundwork for future negotiations. Aaron said it was premature to expect any agreement on this, noting that Israeli Prime Minister Shamir is expected in Washington next month. Next week, the U.S. ambassador to Tunis is expected to ask the PLO to take similar confidence-building measures, such as stopping violent demonstrations in the occupied territories or halting PLO attacks on Israeli targets. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Moderate Israelis and Palestinian officials ended a three-day conference in New York today with an appeal to the Bush administration, Jim Zaroli reports.
The conference was said to be the largest of its kind ever held and the first to be conducted on U.S. soil. As it ended today, several Palestinian and Israeli officials attending held a press conference where they reaffirmed calls for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state on presently occupied territory. They also criticized the Bush administration, saying the confidence-building measures now being undertaken by the U.S. toward the Palestinians were too little too late. They said now is the time for more active direct negotiations among the parties involved. Nabil Sha'ath is an advisor to PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat.
We feel that there is an Israeli voice that can share with the Palestinian voice a real search for the future. We want a two-state solution.
Sha'ath said conferences like today's would help create a climate of peace and would lay the groundwork for the talks. For National Public Radio, this is Jim Zaroli in New York.
At the Iran-Contra trial of Oliver North, former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane was back on the stand today. McFarlane is a prosecution witness. He's the only person who can establish that letters sent to Congress under his signature containing outright lies were drafted by North. NPR's Nina Totenberg has details.
On the witness stand today, McFarlane sought to both take responsibility for misleading Congress and to avoid it. The result was testimony so contradictory that Judge Gerhard Gesell interrupted a number of times to say he couldn't understand McFarlane, and the chief prosecuting attorney by afternoon was actively trying to impeach the credibility of his own witness. Typical was this exchange, said the prosecutor. Was there any discussion of lying to Congress? McFarlane, no. Was there any discussion of providing less than complete information? Answer, not per se. My instructions to North were, you don't lie, you put your own interpretation on the truth. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
Astronauts on the shuttle Discovery have successfully deployed a $100 million communications satellite that will allow NASA almost constant contact with future shuttle crews. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 24 points today to close at 2306.25. You're listening to NPR.
This is Fresh Air. The music of pianist Rand Blake has been influenced by the jazz tradition, but jazz critic Evan Whitehead says it's also been influenced by Béla Bartók, Charles Ives, gospel and Sephardic music, film noir, and the New England landscape where Blake grew up and now lives. Jazz critic Evan Whitehead has a review of Blake's latest album.
Blake is one of the most remarkable of American musicians and a favorite of critics. But even his most ardent admirers may sell him short by focusing only on the dark side of his musical personality. Admittedly, they have good reason to portray him as a gloom monger. A Blake album from a couple of years ago, The Short Life of Barbara Monk, contains several meditations on death and suicide. Blake's newest release, Painted Rhythms Volume 2, a solo piano CD on the GM label, has its share of bleak material as well. Even his settings of medieval Spanish folk songs reflect New England's craggy terrain, harsh climate, and Puritan sense of doom. But there is another side to Rand Blake. Like New England's Charles Ives, to whom he's often compared, Blake's also a bit of a musical comedian. Last summer at the Montreal Jazz Festival, for example, he improvised whimsical accompaniments to silent films of the 1920s. It's significant that Blake's favorite jazz pianist is Thelonious Monk. Monk's style, like his own, could be stark and witty at the same time. With Blake, as with Monk, there's no wasted motion. And like Monk, he makes expressive use of musical devices that may sound to skeptics like mistakes. A case in point is Blake's latest version of Scott Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag, where he expands and contracts individual phrases like a pianist who keeps losing his place. But Maple Leaf Rag works on several levels, not all of them comic. Here's the complete performance. Maple Leaf Rag touches on a lot of Rand Blake's virtues, his abrupt and unpredictable mood swings, his amazingly varied and precise touch at the keyboard, his quirky approach to tradition and unique blending of jazz and classical influences. It shows why he's impossible to pigeonhole. Rand Blake is head of the Department of Third Stream Music at the New England Conservatory. Third stream is a term Gunther Schuller coined to describe music that's informed by the jazz and classical traditions, but which belongs to neither. Blake has called it a label for anti-label music, music like his that won't be limited either to the jazz tradition, broad as it is, or to the tragic mode. To borrow Duke Ellington's favorite compliment, Rand Blake is beyond category.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Rand Blake's new album, Painted Rhythms, Volume 2, on the GM label. Rand Blake won a MacArthur Award last year. This is Fresh Air.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a truly remarkable book. The introduction starts like this. Space, it says, is big, really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the street to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space. Listen! And so on. After a while, the style settles down a bit, and it starts telling you things you actually need to know, like the fact that the fabulously beautiful planet Bethsilemin is now so worried about the cumulative erosion caused by 10 million visiting tourists a year that any net imbalance between the amount you eat and the amount you excrete whilst on the planet is surgically removed from your body weight when you leave. So every time you go to the lavatory there, it's vitally important to get a receipt.
That was an excerpt of the BBC radio series, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Douglas Adams created the series in 1978. It traced the intergalactic adventures of Ford Prefect, who was researching the ultimate travel guide, and his reluctant Earthborn companion Arthur Dent. The series was a huge success and spawned its own mini-industry. Adams followed the radio drama with four Hitchhiker novels, which became bestsellers in England and the United States, where Hitchhiker was broadcast by NPR. There are also records, plays, a television version, and an interactive computer game. Adams' latest two books are set on Earth, featuring Dirk Gently, Holistic Detective. The new book, The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul, opens at Heathrow Airport.
It can hardly be a coincidence that no language on Earth has ever produced the expression as pretty as an airport. Airports are ugly. Some are very ugly. Some attain a degree of ugliness that can only be the result of a special effort. This ugliness arises because airports are full of people who are tired, cross, and have just discovered that their luggage has landed in Murmansk. A Murmansk airport is the only known exception to this otherwise infallible rule. And architects have on the whole tried to reflect this in their designs. They have sought to highlight the tiredness and crossness motif with brutal shapes and nerve-jangling colours to make effortless the business of separating the traveller forever from his or her luggage or loved ones, to confuse the traveller with arrows that appear to point at the windows, distant Tyrax or the current position of Ursa Minor in the night sky, and wherever possible to expose the plumbing on the grounds that it is functional and conceal the location of the departure gates, presumably on the grounds that they are not. Caught in the middle of a sea of hazy light and a sea of hazy noise, Kate Schechter stood and doubted.
Well, she is on her way to Norway, but at the airport while she's there, the terminal blows up. And first the PLO and the RA take credit for it, but the official conclusion is what?
Well, the official conclusion is that it's an act of God in the end, and the question is which God and why, and what God would be hanging around the Terminal 2 of Heathrow trying to catch the 3:37 to Oslo.
Now, you actually introduce a couple of gods in this. I couldn't help but wonder what you were reading when you decided to introduce Thor, the Norse god of thunder, into your book.
Well, it was just trying to think about how gods would actually live and exist in today's world, and what it would be like for them, because not only, I felt, would they be sort of completely hamstrung by it and unable to cope with it, but, I mean, the world has changed so much that they would just have no place in it, and I just felt would probably become destitute, which is what has happened to them.
Well, I'm going to leave the plot complications regarding the gods to your detective, Dirk Gently, to solve, but I'm going to ask you about something very mundane in your novel, and that is that the American character in it is obsessed, while she's in London, with finding a pizza place that delivers. I guess yeah. I guess yes. The London pizza places don't deliver. Is this your view of Americans, that we all want pizza delivered? And yeah,
I remember, because I lived in Los Angeles a few years ago, and we always used to have pizzas delivered to us, and it was infuriating that in England you just can't do it. In fact, since the book... I mean, literally in the last 6 months since I finished the book, one or two pizza places have started to deliver. I don't know if this is because in shame after what I said.
This is an example of a novel having profound repercussions.
Well, actually, oddly enough, there was one thing I was going to put in the book and then didn't. Because it's set in the same area that I live, and I've always wanted there to be a sushi bar near where I live. So I was going to have an incredibly successful sushi bar opening up in the book, sort of opening up just around the corner from me, and hope that somebody would take the hint.
Well, one thing you do have in your new novel is a computerized I Ching, which is interesting idea.
Well, it's funny how, I mean, every time you think you've thought of something far too absurd, you find, I mean, the next day that somebody else has actually done it. And you can now get, somebody's done a program for the Macintosh computer, which is the one I use, where you can consult the I Ching electronically. There was another thing in the book that I gave to Dirk a habit of my own, which is a certain means of navigation. I'm very bad at navigating, and I always get lost when I'm driving around London. And I use a system of sort of Zen navigation, which is if I don't know where I'm going, then I find a car that looks as if it knows where it's going, and I follow it. And it's always very effective. I mean, the effect may not be the effect I was after, but there's usually an effect. And then just a couple of months ago, I was staying in near Big Sur in Northern California, and came across a bookstore where they had a copy of a book called Zen Driving, How to Be a Buddha Behind the Wheel. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I don't suppose you can get this book outside Northern California. I don't know.
Actually, I've seen the book.
Have you?
Yeah, so I want to attest to the fact that you're not making this up. Your novels are filled with the big metaphysical questions. Did you ever study philosophy?
No, no. No, I studied English literature when I was at university. But always worried that I should have studied either history or medicine, or very often I wish I'd done natural sciences, i.e. physics and maths.
I feel like you're a psychiatrist here, but were you a brooder? Did you used to lay around in college wondering about the meaning of life?
I don't know about I suppose I don't know that I wandered around thinking about the meaning of life, but I was always a bit of a brooder and a worrier. I think as a kid I was I was once seen actually to walk in broad daylight, slap bang into a lamppost. My mother used to worry about me. She hoped there was something going on the inside, because it sure as hell didn't seem to be anything going on the outside.
Now, you went to Cambridge. This
yes.
was late 60s, early 70s, right?
No, 71 to 74 I was at Cambridge.
Did you work for the College Humor magazine, anything like that?
It's funny, recently, my mother got in touch with me and said, look, I've just come across in the attic an old box full of your stuff from school, and I think it's time you looked after this. And I thought, well, I'll look through this and see what I was writing in those days. And, of course, there was hardly anything by me whatsoever, largely because, and this is a habit that I've carried on into my sort of professional life, I was always incredibly late with deadlines. And so I would always miss publication.
Okay. How did you start working at the BBC, which is where Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was first produced?
Well, I suppose I'd always thought I was going to be primarily a scriptwriter, but no, and basically I was having a lot of no success because I wasn't very good at writing sketches to order. The one sketch I remember of mine on the radio that actually, as much as anything else, had to do with my then being successful in getting Hitchhiker on. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say it, but it was a sketch about a kamikaze pilot being briefed for his 19th mission, and the commanding officer is trying very patiently to explain to him exactly what it was he was doing wrong.
So how did you come up with the idea for Hitchhikers?
There's lying drunk in a field in Innsbruck, you know, the way one does. This was 1971, before I even went up to university. I was hitchhiking around Europe, and I had a copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to Europe. And as I say, I was lying drunk in this field, the stars came out, and it occurred to me at the time that somebody ought to write A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy as well. The odd thing about that story is that I've now told it so many times, because everybody asks me in every single interview, you know, how did you get the idea for Hitchhiker? Right. And so I tell the story again. But I now, because I've told the story so often, I now have no memory at all of the actual event.
Oh, I think I know what you mean, and you probably wonder if you've made it up.
Yes, well, all I can say is I've only got my own word for it.
Wasn't there supposed to be a film version?
Don't make me cry. Yes, there was meant to be a film version. I doubt if it'll ever happen.
What happened?
Hollywood.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've heard this story before.
I think
before.
That says as much as right. You need to know.
Douglas Adams, thanks a lot for talking with us.
All right, thanks, Terry.
Douglas Adams' new book is The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
A tentative settlement today in federal court in Manhattan in the United States wanted to take over the Teamsters Union because the government felt it was being controlled by organized crime. There's a settlement there. Former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane in Washington, testifying at the Oliver North trial, says he never did tell Oliver North to lie to Congress. And a report from the Rio Grande Valley of Texas along the border about the use of dogs to catch drug smugglers in that territory and how the dogs are sometimes in great danger because they're being so effective. We'll meet a couple of dogs named Barco and Rocky.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last Wednesday night, ABC's Nightline had a special show ready to go about veterans returning to Vietnam, but it was bumped by late-breaking coverage of the failing John Tower nomination. The network rescheduled the show for this Wednesday. Television critic David Bianculli has a preview. He's noticed the extended Nightline will be broadcast on the same night as another ABC show about the war.
Wednesday night on China Beach, the ABC drama series about Vietnam, actual Vietnam War veterans take turns telling their stories. They do it witness style, like the people in Warren Beatty's film Reds. And as they do, scenes from previous episodes of China Beach dramatize and parallel the emotions and events they're describing. Later, after China Beach and the local news are over, ABC returns with Nightline in a one-hour special episode about eight war veterans who returned to Vietnam to confront their fears, their memories, and themselves. Taken together, these two shows are an unusual and unforgettable double feature. At first, I was skeptical about China Beach. I liked the series, but I thought the idea of mixing real veterans' memories with clips from the show would be too self-serving, a kind of look-how-accurate-we've-been showcase. Instead, the juxtaposition is pretty powerful. Here's actress Chloe Webb as a USO performer who listens as a severely burned soldier describes a woman he saw at a USO show.
What a voice. What a set of knockers.
Great big ones, huh?
Oh, no, just right ones. I got a picture.
You do?
It's in my pocket.
You don't have many pockets left.
She looks at the picture and sees that it's her. It's a dramatic moment, made more dramatic by a similar story told right after that by an actual USO entertainer.
And I remember him looking at me, and he told me that he had my picture in his pocket. And first, you know, I thought, right, you know, and I looked in the pocket, and it was a picture that he had taken of me at the Bob Hope show. And, you know, it always meant so much to me because, you know, of all his worldly possessions, of all the things that meant the most to him, that was it, my picture, and he had it in his pocket. And before he died, he told me he wanted me to have that. So I have that picture.
Later the same night on ABC, unless there's some major breaking news story to preempt it, Nightline and Ted Koppel will talk about Vietnam as well.
In late January, 8 Vietnam veterans and 2 therapists flew to Vietnam. The object was to help the veterans, each of whom suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, to face and deal with their memories of the war.
One veteran dismisses the trip as a waste, but the others seem truly affected by returning to Vietnam. One veteran says with amazement that even the land has healed. And a visit to northern Vietnam stuns most of them because of the reaction they get from their former enemies, and especially from the children.
You got more of a coming home after 20 years from those people, those little kids and stuff, than my government gave me. When I came home, my God.
This Nightline could have been, and perhaps should have been, a full-length documentary. There's a sense that a lot of the stories are only partially told. Even so, hearing only portions of the veteran stories, on Nightline and on China Beach, is much better than hearing only the sounds of silence. Watch both shows, and listen, too.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Robert McNeil, the co-anchor of the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, has written a memoir about his lifelong fascination with language. On the next Fresh Air, McNeil talks about his own speaking style, which has been influenced by broadcasting in Canada, England, and the United States. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Sam Phillips, the man who founded Sun Records. And book critic John Leonard reviews Somoza Falling, Anthony Lake's study of America's role in Nicaragua. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.